Welcome to Season 2 of the Unscripted Medicine Podcast, a podcast about living and learning at the UC College of Medicine.
On the show, we discuss everything from board exam prep, how to excel in your clinical clerkships, and also how to do the little things required to thrive in medical school.
Check out the show notes or our website for more information, helpful links, resources, and more.
Please connect with us via email or on Twitter. We would love to hear from you. Without further ado, we hope you enjoy today's episode.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the Unscripted Medicine Podcast. It is Robbie here, and I am thrilled to introduce to you all Dr. Latifa Silski. She is one of my favorite surgeons who I had the pleasure of working with at UC. She trained undergrad in Cleveland at Case Western, went to the University of Michigan for medical school. She was confused, went south to Columbus for Ohio State for residency and fellowship. And now we're thrilled to have her here as a transplant surgeon at the University of Cincinnati, who has been getting more involved with med students throughout her tenure here and a great mentor to many. So Dr. Silski, would love to hear you, anything else you've added or would like to add, and then maybe just want to hear how you feel about having been in Ann Arbor and Columbus for so much of your life. How's that?
Well, thank you for inviting me. This is awesome. I'm glad you're doing this. It's pretty magical. I listened to some of your episodes. I think you're doing amazing stuff.
Well, thank you.
That is awesome. Ann Arbor and Columbus, it's crazy. It's a crazy transition. But especially if you don't know that much about sports, you kind of have to fake it because it's like people are so passionate about it. But it is a great tool because especially if you have an older patient, male, who doesn't really want to talk, and then they see that little Michigan pin on your jacket and it just flares them up, and then you get to start a conversation. So it was great from that standpoint. But there are a lot of funny stories with my hats disappearing the day of the game and then reappearing. Because, you know, people were alerted to maize and blue, but it was a great time. Yeah. Also super confusing if you don't know things because people just walk up and ask you random questions about people. And you're like, yes, I'm excited about this. But it's great.
Yeah. I'm sure there was a few game days in which you were overlooking the shoe and you're just like, oh, wait, why is there traffic this morning?
Exactly. Yeah. I had gone to one Michigan game and I had no idea they could look like that because at Case Western football was not that big of a passion. So, yeah, it was like a culture shock. So, you know, but I'm glad it makes people so happy. It's an awesome kind of thing to have.
Well, we're glad that you ventured down to Cincinnati. You've completed the I-71 tour from Cleveland down to Cincinnati.
Warmer every degree. I'll take it.
Absolutely. That's a good way to think about it. And also would love to hear maybe a little bit about your support system in Cincinnati, your family, and who came with you when you made the trip down to Cincinnati.
So I live with my husband, Eric, and my awesome, beautiful, amazing daughter, who I think is the best person in the whole world, which will probably lead to her having problems later on, but she's amazing. No. She's 6 and a half. And then I have, I even hesitate calling it, but I have a live-in nanny, but she's been living us for almost 5 years. So it's like if I say nanny, it feels weird because she's our family and our friend. My brother jokes is my paid friend. I'm like, oh, you're just stabbing me in my heart. But yeah, so she moved with us, which we were very, very grateful for. My husband's currently not working a lot. So, you know, now it's just, yeah, we just hang out whenever we can. And then my parents, well, my mother lives in Cleveland. So it's just like 4 hours away. One of my brothers and one of my sisters lives there. So not that far away, but here in this area I have. And then you just make family where you go. So I have a friend of mine that lives really close by who we work together, Sarah Dixon, and now she lives close by. So she has two kids and kids kind of hang out together and it's pretty nice.
Cool. I love to hear it. I want to transition a little bit into our topic for today, which would be your specialty, which is transplant surgery. So would love to hear you give an introduction as far as what all things you're transplanting, because you don't transplant everything, but I'm sure that you work on more than maybe our listeners would know. So what organ systems in particular are you transplanting? And then tell me just a little bit about your surgery, your specialty.
So transplant is amazing, especially transplant surgery. I'm, you know, super biased, but essentially we joke that we're below the diaphragm is where we work. So we transplant liver transplants, pancreas transplants, and kidney. Those three organs are my zone. Obviously there's recovery surgeries that we do that, you know, are rescue organ surgeries where patients or patients' families have decided to actually give of themselves. And those are the other surgeries that we participate in. And of course, the very happy kind where a living kidney donor wants to give it while they're alive. And they're like, hey, I want to either give to my family member or altruistically to help somebody and make their life better. I also do dialysis access surgery. And those are all the kinds of surgeries that prolong life in order to try to get people to transplant. So that includes doing fistulas and grafts and PD catheter placements and some advanced technologies like Hero grafts and things like that, just to try to get patients to transplant. And if they're not transplant candidates, keep them alive and well and as much as well as we can, so they can thrive in the however they want to live their life. So those are the breadth of my clinical practice. As far as the schedule can be weird, and that's basically what I talk about when I. Well, I talk about this often as far as like when you're choosing specialties, how you have to figure out, you have to really know yourself. So even within surgery, so I look at somebody like Mary Stever, who is a trauma critical care person. The schedule is very set. They do, you know, set amount of schedules. They know set amount of call days. But what comes in can be every part of the body, and the surgery is undetermined. They're just going in, have, you know, it could be a gallbladder one day, gunshot wound, colon resection. The breadth of the operations they do is pretty wide. Then you can look at somebody like Dr. Tammy Holmes, endocrine surgeon. She knows the exact day of her surgeries, the perfect imaging, everything is done previously. And then you look at transplant, I potentially do 5 or 6 surgeries, but they can happen anytime. And the mystery lies in what is going to you're going to have at that moment. And to plug transplant a little bit, transplant's the most medicine of surgeries. So you also get to do a lot of immunology. You're doing a lot of blood pressure management, electrolyte management, a lot of critical care kind of transitions over onto it as well for very sick liver and kidney patients. So it's a very medical specialty with very unpredictable schedule, but your surgery numbers are not. So you basically try to get to be an expert on the thing that you do. So this number of surgeries are pretty narrow. But each patient is so unique that you always are challenged because surprises happen all the time. So that's transplant in a nutshell.
Yeah, that's awesome. For our listeners to know, I was with Dr. Soski for probably a week or 2 weeks in third year, which was 2 years back since I've come off the research year, but got to do multiple kidney transplants with her. And then also we did a dialysis access case. I remember it vividly because it was a Beyonce case. that was the only music we had on the whole case. And it stuck out to me. So
guilty.
She has been known to have a pretty rockin' playlist. So what would you say is your go-to, or like, how do you decide what's going to be on in it during a case?
It depends on the timing. So I have a 3 a.m. playlist that is pretty jamming and it's pretty broad. And then, of course, Beyonce, you know, guilty. I had a Hamilton week where all access cases had Hamilton until I saw tears in the scrub tech's eyes. It was like, please, doctor, don't do this to me another day. Yes, I will. Okay, we're done. Just tell me what you cannot listen to, and then we'll go from there. But yeah, Hamilton had a big run recently. But Beyonce is, you know, Beyonce is Beyonce. I'm Sasha Fierce. I had a period where I was like, you know, I'm Sasha Fierce. I can't do a stage thing, but I can be fierce in normal life.
Oh, yeah. Know? And if I do recall, occasionally, although masked, you do participate with your vocals as well.
That's what I'm talking about. I can't sing on a stage. I sound good in the hospital because nobody else is singing.
It's true. Yes.
But I cannot sing on a stage because I cannot really sing.
Well, I thought you were fantastic, and it makes it fun to be in there because they're high stress scenarios. Obviously, each case is a little bit different. When you're doing a liver transplant, there are moments when everyone is silent and very focused, but there are other moments that are more routine, and you know, you can belt out the chorus for a little bit, which made it a great moment as a trainee to be able to know there were places for all things in the OR.
Yeah. Kristen Gooding was a transplant fellow when I was a medical student. And I knew I was a little bit weird, and then she was a little bit weird. I was like, you know what? I can be a surgery person. I can swing down the hallways. That is totally fine. but she was one of the people that inspired me to be who I needed to be, because we need a lot of varied type of people in surgery. So,
yeah.
You know, there's no actual personality for any kind of specialty. So it's good to have the room to kind of be who you need to be. And you're right. During surgery, this is your life. You spend a lot of time in the space. You have to be able to make people feel like we can do good things together.
Yeah, absolutely. I love how you said that we need all types of people in the OR taking care of our patients. I recently had seen a Twitter post about you being one of a select few black female transplant surgeons. I think you mentioned that there are 9 in the country training at the moment. So just love to hear your thoughts on that. It's awesome to be a part of such a cool group, but a group that hopefully we see grow. Unfortunately, it is a little low.
It is. I think we're going to be working on ASTS, which is the transplant body, is really trying to have a new initiative called Boldly Against Racism to try to actually even just collect more data, because it was interesting how we found each other. Praise, one of the other doctors that is featured in that picture, you know, was determined to find stories of black female doctors in general. And in that process, she kind of found us. Kristen Gooding, who I mentioned earlier, was a fellow who was a transplant fellow at Michigan when I was a medical student. And she had been also trying to just locate all the people that she could find to kind of generate a community, because there are some unique challenges, especially when it comes to patient care. And until there's that difference in patient care, we do need some different perspectives. And then we can generate allies and make it so that we can decrease healthcare disparities. And that ends up being, at this point, sad, but true. We just need more diversity in order to kind of highlight those areas. So Kristen Gooding is very passionate about that, and she kind of mentors all of us to try to make sure that we have the ability to stay strong, stay in engaged. And Velma, the person in the center of that picture, she's the first black transplant surgeon in the country. So when Kristen Gooding was like at Michigan, they're like, "Oh, you're the first one." She's like, "That's not possible. I cannot possibly be the first one." And then she actually, you know, met Velma. But, you know, those are her stories to tell. But it's kind of interesting how, you know, we came together. I think more were trained, but as far as practicing at this point, that's what we have. I'd be happy to find if somebody else can find some more, because that would be great if we've missed somebody.
Yeah, but, well, hopefully we have some awesome UCOM listeners who will be inspired to join the ranks. We can also include that photo. It was posted on Twitter, so we can put a link to that in our show notes for this episode. So thank you for standing amongst being that pioneering group. We have done intentional episodes on the podcast trying to amplify the voice of those who maybe didn't have the mic for as long in our history, talking to a lot of female doctors about their tenure as mothers and wives in medicine, and navigating some of those barriers, and more recently trying to increase representation of physicians of color. So we are with you and are so glad that you get to be a voice for students here in Cincinnati. So we thank you for that, Dr. Selsky. I have been on service watching what's felt like weeks at a time, or a week at a time was pretty consistent in a given month, where you would be doing if we had an increase in kidney donors for whatever reason, you have some scheduled kidney donors, like the live kidney donors or liver. So how does a week or maybe a month look as far as a workflow for those who have never worked with a transplant surgeon?
So different transplant programs might run it differently, but in general here, the way our schedule works is we're on call for 1 week at a time. And then you're on call for either kidney call or liver call. When you're on call, you get offers from around the country and locally for people that come onto the list. So if a patient is passed in Mexico, then it doesn't really matter. But the United States is divided into several regions, and then we get calls for in that region. It's usually local or kind of in the closer space that we have, so Michigan, Indiana. So those calls can come out 24 hours a day, and we have about 20 minutes to kind of decide the offer that we have. Can we use it for the patient that came up on the list or not? Is this organ good enough for this patient? So most of our decision making is happening in a very small amount of time. So you kind of have to know your list and kind of know that patient, and you go through and you have to say yes or no and have those kidneys transported. So let's say you're on a kidney week. And a general kidney week at UC, we have a planned living donor, usually on Monday morning. A living donor is somebody who has decided to go through a workup to kind of give up a kidney to a friend, family member, or a complete stranger. So usually those cases are planned. We do our rounding as planned. We do that case. And in the meantime, you're getting offers. And the rest of the schedule is whatever comes. We obviously have clinic. We have clinic 2 days a week for kidney clinic, which is where we see new potential transplant recipients. We have a third clinic that's for donors, that, you know, for two to three donors, you know, on the that day of clinic. Our clinics are very multidisciplinary. I kind of alluded to the fact that I think that was one of the things that drew me to really to transplant. I think it's one of the places in medicine that really has to successfully do that because the system allows it and it is financially built in. So everybody would love to have a social worker that's helping out, but not every part of medicine has that resource of having that extra person. So with our meetings that we have, our clinic, we have a surgeon there, we have a nephrologist there, then we have a social worker, several nurse coordinators, we have a dietitian. So a whole group of people that are evaluating that also includes a financial person who goes through finances and sees what kind of insurance they have, what kind of insurance that they need, if what kind of Medicaid plans that they have to arrange. And once all this data generation occurs Monday in the afternoon, we sit down and we discuss patients. Say, okay, who can be a transplant candidate? Who can't be a transplant candidate yet, but who can we get better? Do this person need a cardiologist to see one more time? Do they need another dental clearance? Do they need another letter from a cancer specialist, et cetera, et cetera? So that's a true multidisciplinary meeting, which also has our pharmacy group that's in there talking about their medications, different medications that might be applicable to them. We discuss their immune suppression plan. If there's something unique, somebody who has lupus or somebody who has clotting disorders, et cetera. So what would our plan be once they're on the list? So that meeting is about 2 hours long on Monday. And either we get approved pending something, or maybe we have to fix X, Y, and Z. Sometimes it might be for like the liver meeting. You might have it kind of mimics the same setup. That's on a Tuesday meetings. Same setup as mimic. But sometimes in those situations, you might also have to have planning for like, okay, X person needs to stay on, you know, in the queue, so to speak, for several months while they prove that they are sober or not doing the things that are harming themselves. So all those discussions happen on those meeting days, which are Monday and Tuesday, Monday for kidney and Tuesday for livers. So those are one of the several multidisciplinary meetings that we do. We have a lot of them. We have a couple of meetings that we look at biopsies. So we get the biopsies for the patients who have been transplanted. In that meeting, we also have, if it's liver one, we have a multiple hepatologists, hepatology fellows, residents, fellows, whoever is interested. And then we go through the images and the story and the actual histology. Similarly, we might have to do it one or twice a week. But in general, at least once a week, we're going through slides, et cetera. So there's a lot of meetings that go along with it where we are actually teaming up with other specialists to kind of make sure that we get real 360-degree care. So that's kind of how the structured part of the day works. And the unstructured part of the day is just whatever happens. So I think part of the reason why it's transplant, because, you know, obviously people ask, why are our livers always at nighttime? And that's based on how resources are allocated at each hospital. So if you're a small local hospital and you have scheduled cases from like 7 a.m. to 5 o'clock, you're not going to want to, because you have the ability to, you can put the donor later in the day rather than move around your scheduled cases, because those patients also had scheduled times. So inevitably, the donor ends up being at nighttime. So since it gets moved to like 8, 9, 10 o'clock, the liver cannot sustain, even though some of the textbooks say they can last forever on ice. I like to see what I do ask people, like, how long do you think a kidney lasts? crazy amount of hours. But the liver, and it, inevitably, if the donor is later in the night, then the liver is going to go, you know, 2, 3 a.m. So that's what we joke about. My block time is, you know, 1 a.m. You know, it's my block time is 1 a.m. or 3 a.m. because that's when we're going to do the liver. And if, especially if that donor is able to donate more than one organ and we are the recipients of those, then you have the two kidneys after that. So for transplant, you need to have like a group that we have. Our surgery group is, you know, very tight. So if you start getting tired, you're like, hey, Dr. Shah, do you want to cover a kidney for me? Or, you know, they'll call me, hey, do you want to cover this part of the liver? Hey, can you cover this access case for me? Because part of the schedule is going to be rotating all the time. And since there's a time limit on how long you can keep organs not plugged in, there's a time pressure there. So, you know, when people ask me like, hey, is transplant ever going to be like, have an awesome schedule? Not really. I don't see a way. I'm sure there's a possible way, but it will have to be if we get better technology. That's where a lot of the research comes in, where we're talking about, you know, better perfusion devices or repair devices where you can theoretically put a liver on there and have it run through with real blood and, you know, repair the organ. And then you can maybe schedule the livers. With kidney, you get a little bit of leeway, but not a lot about how far you can go, because you want it, the sooner you put the organ back into a human body, the better it works. So you try not to get too much cold ischemia time on it if it can. So it's fairly unpredictable.
And for our viewers or listeners rather who haven't been a part of this experience, you often have two ORs going if it's a living kidney donor or if it's not having been brought in. And it's a really neat experience going from one room where you're seeing it taken out. You're literally watching it walk, go over. You got to kind of go to the back table for a little bit, prep things. And then, you know, within, it's not too much longer, you see perfusion. And if I may, watching a kidney come back to life to me was akin to childbirth, like new life for the first time versus like second life. And it's a cool, really awesome experience. So would love to maybe hear you talk about that. Is that something that gets old, or how much of that is what drew you to the field, this opportunity for whether it was self-inflicted harm or run of the mill, it just happened. What's that experience like?
And that's what it really comes down to, right? Why would you do this to yourself? You do this for those moments. There's no better magic than you see another chance. A lot of our healthcare system is not necessarily set up to prevent for prevention. Yeah. And, you know, I came in as a slightly older person, slightly older person. And you're trying to figure out how do you feel that you fit in to make the world a better place? Is it on an individual level, or is it patient to patient? Okay, I'm going to go to medicine because I like to do an individual level. Then you have to figure out what you're doing. So I was one of those people that was always considered a family medicine personality.
Because you sing Beyonce in the hallways.
Because I sing Beyonce in the hallways. I also do Disney, you know. So, you know, the Disney princess thing was a theme when I was a resident. but when you come to transplant, I don't think of it as self-inflicted, but it's, you know, at that point, people have come to the place where whatever they were doing or whatever that happened to them, they knew it's not working anymore. Hmm. And you have the chance to try to be like, okay, let's see if we can try something different. Yeah. We can try something different. And this time, the system is giving us enough resources to work on it to get you to play where you need to be. I would love to be obsolete in some ways because that would be super exciting. But we're not there yet. But transplant was one of those places, as opposed to a lot of other fields. When you're in transplant, you're like, okay, we're starting anew. Somebody gave us this magical gift, and now you can start. You can do the things you needed to do. You see the patient talk about what they're, hey, I'm going to be free from dialysis. I have 4 days free that I can do whatever I want to do with my life. I can be normal. I can get a job that I want to do. And it's amazing. And you have the financial help and the systemic help to kind of make them be able to do that. If we had the ability to have the resource for making sure everybody quit smoking, vascular surgery would have less amputations that they would have to do. They would have to do less triple bypasses, all those things. But we do things after the fact. And that's an unfortunate reality of where we are right now. But in transplant, we actually have to have the ability to kind of make it better. And on the other side, we're able to bring some closure when people lose family members to have something not terrible come out of that. And that's kind of one of the amazing experiences I get to have when we have meetings with donor families who are, you know, now willing to share their story of, you know, their loss and what it meant to be able to have somebody be rescued when they could not rescue their family member. And being part of that piece is priceless. It's priceless to say, okay, we can bring somebody else closure. And in that closure, another person gets another chance at a new life. And it's really amazing. I've had experiences where you've taken care of a liver patient and, you know, you see them a year later. I remember walking in the hallways. I'm like, wow, that person's voice sounds so familiar. I walked by again. He's like, it is me.
Oh my gosh.
He was in the hospital for like 6 months. It was like just watching him suffer was incredible. And then I had seen him. He's like a real estate agent. He's like gained a bunch of weight and he was looking beautiful. And I'm like, oh, that is so magical. It is. It's the reason why you're okay with the schedule.
Yeah.
It is the reason why you're okay with the schedule, because you have great opportunities to be. There's still sorrows. It's not all, you know, rescuing, but you have amazing ability to kind of give somebody another chance, and you have enough help to make sure you can do that. I mean, and again, multi-D is my word, and that's what really makes it happen. It's a lot of people that go into it. A lot of people that you don't know, like perfusionists, people who are help transporting the organs, I mean, running lists, doing all the kinds of things, that taking care of donor patients who, once you've been declared a donor and you're brain dead, these patient people take over. The OPOs that kind of manage the donor, manage, you know, all the care of the family, and, you know, transition them to try to see if they can find some peace. So there's so many people that we don't get to see that are involved in getting, having that miracle of seeing that kidney pink up and starting to, like, have urine. It's amazing. I don't know if anybody's excited about pee more than transplant surgeons. You're some pee.
to cheer about urine.
Yes.
And you said OPO, is that organ procurement officer?
Organization.
Okay.
So they're independent organizations that are charged with kind of, they get the first calls essentially, and they basically are the first people who run through and see if somebody is eligible or not. They're not necessarily associated with any transplant center, so they're supposed to be completely independent. They'll have medical people on the board, so one of us can be on the medical board to kind of assist and direct, but we play not as big of a role, just kind of give medical advice on, you know, okay, are we going to use patients' organs for COVID positive or not? What is the evidence? What we're going to talk about, et cetera. So they have some connection like this, but essentially OPOs are the groups that kind of, and there's different OPOs, every region has different amounts, and those are the organizations that help kind of usher the kidneys and livers and the pancreas and the hearts, yes, above the diaphragm. I keep forgetting they also do all the other organs too. But those organizations have a lot of people that also are involved to kind of help, you know, usher new life.
Yeah, before I forget, I just wanted to add one experience I had, which was really impactful for me. We had an individual who had been declared brain dead, and we were doing a harvest, and there were multiple providers from all over the Midwest. There were folks coming from Michigan, Ohio State, I think even the clinic in Cleveland, and all working together to bring life to multiple people across the Midwest. You know, it was within a matter of a day, multiple people's lives are going to be impacted. And being there for the entire 10-hour experience as working with the cardiothoracic surgeons above the diaphragm, and then our home folks who were working on the kidneys. And then across the street, we had, I think Dr. Tao came over from Children's, and it was a really cool experience. It was emotional and not like anything I had experienced before in the OR. Thankfully, all the patients I worked with had great outcomes on surge onc and transplant. But then as the anesthesiologist walked out of the room, I thought to myself, I've never been in a case in which the anesthesiologist is no longer needed. But to take that step back and to know that so many people would be impacted positively It's felt like a holy moment and one that I think will stick with me for a long time.
It is very sacred. It's really a privilege to be part of that process.
Absolutely. I did, just because I think our listeners can handle it, would love to hear maybe your record of either surgeries in a row, or just because I know transplant surgeons can go, like, I've seen you coming from like your second day, or you're probably talented at sleeping in your office, but like, what is that record, or what would you feel comfortable sharing?
There's
and now that you're always attending,
very rested.
And now that you're in attending, obviously, as a trainee, we're held to work duty hours. And you had mentioned that you have a phenomenal team, which I can second. I've worked with a handful of your colleagues, and they're awesome, who can tag in and help. But you guys do have long stretches when you are on call that it's kind of crazy.
It is crazy.
Maybe not your record. Maybe like December. I know you're on call over Christmas.
So the longest is probably during fellowship. Which was, I think, six livers and four kidneys in a period of 49 hours.
Oh my gosh.
But the longest I've been, so I'll share this. I know the better living through pharmacy, i.e. NSAID combination with coffee, that can get you to 3.5 hours not feeling terrible, 3.5 days not feeling terrible. But obviously, to get that secret formula, you've had to have enough practice to try to still be like, oh, I am still perky and great. Coffee, water, NSAIDs, and Tylenol. There's a formula that can get you there. But not sure I can continue to do that until I'm 80. The longest it's infrequent. I mean, it's easy to track. So if you look at last week, you can go continuously. Yeah. And I think one of the things that I, and talking about duty hours, and it's certainly interesting. Obviously, I laugh because, we do things that, you're trying to do things for the right reasons. You do make it your duty hours. But one of the times when I was a resident, I was on fellow call for vascular surgery. And I remember we started on Friday morning operating and had gone to home maybe 2.5 hours the whole weekend. And the rest of the time we were operating. And now it's Monday night at like 5 o'clock. I'm a PGY3 at this time. And I'm feeling tired. And I'm just doing that thing where you're kind of like, I call it roboting, where you can only move one hand at a time because you're just tired and you're like one hand. And the attending looks at me and, much older than me, and is like, oh, you should go rest. I'm good. I'll just finish this with a tech. And I'm just like, you're so embarrassed. Cause like, how is this possible? Him and I were together the entire time and he's still going strong. And it is some of his practice, but obviously my husband's a pilot, so he argues vehemently about workout hours ability to function, etc. But the thing about surgery is that it's a high stress environment in some ways, physiologically. So if you had me sitting down and said, hey, can you stay up for, an exorbitant amount of time? I'm out. And I think one of the skills you have to have on is being able to sleep wherever you need to, 2 seconds at a time. But because your attention is differently choreographed when you're doing surgery, it's a different focus. You feel it once you like scrub out, you're like, oh, wow, yes, my knee hurts. I feel a little pain here and there.
There it is.
But it's mostly the kind of like awkward positional pain that you feel. That's basically the issue. So self-care is important. And I think we're going to eventually find ways of making this less insane. But the idea that you have to keep going is what drives you. You keep going because there's a patient on the other line. I couldn't do that you're like, hey, can you just, watch 18 hours of TV? No, I can't. Like, oh my God, I'm too tired for that. But you tell me I have to be in the OR for, continuously liver, kidney. We'll make it happen. Strategic rest is what they call it.
Strategic rest. That's one way to look at it. But for context, at least the ones I've been in, a kidney is about 3 hours if we're on on track, and then a liver can be 7 to 9. I don't remember going more than 9 for a liver, but I'm sure there are cases that do.
Yeah, there are cases. It all depends. There are kidneys that can go 2.5 hours, and then there are kidneys that can go 6 hours, depending on, you know, what you encounter. And that's basically the magic and mystery of what you encounter. No matter how much you plan, you come across and you're like, oh, this artery is a calcified block. Do I abort the surgery or do I come up with a creative solution with calling your partners at 3 a.m.? Like, hey, I can do this, and do this like a carotid. And then yada, yada, yada. What do you think? Sending pictures in the middle of the night. And that's why you have to have good partners. And then you come up with solutions. So about 3 hours for a kidney. I tell patients' families an hour on each end. So because when you say, when surgeons are measuring time, they're usually measuring from incision to incision.
Yeah.
But really, as you've been in there, there's a lot of pre-work that goes in. So a patient goes in, especially for a liver or kidney, there's about 30 minutes to 40 minutes of prep work, you know, getting extra kind of access to special lines, a lot of timeouts, all these other things that you have to do to make sure the surgery is safe. So from a patient standpoint, I always tell the patients it's 4 hours. I also say, it's not like the movies, where in the movies, if it's going longer, it's a disaster. In real life, it's like, oh, we need an extra instrument, or this is not quite right, or
the med student broke sterile field.
Or the attending. Just yesterday, I turned around, somehow had a huge gaping hole in my gown for at least 30 minutes before somebody noticed it, because I had withdrawn my hand from something burning. And it wasn't until I moved around to the table, I'm like, oh. Well, I have a full elbow exposed. Medical students do it, but other people do it too. We just don't forgive the medical students easily. Like, you did it. I do it all the time. Don't you worry.
It's true. I think I had seen, I don't think I actually, by some grace of God, didn't have any egregious sterile fields, but I did see attendings break, I think, more than any. So just so the listeners know.
Exactly. Nobody's safe from breaking it. There's just different consequences.
It's true.
Someday. Anyway. I lost track of thought now where we were going with that.
Honestly, it was good. I don't remember. I do have a question. I do have a question, though, or just a highlight that I remember. It was before all of our transplant cases. This could have been a UC thing. I don't know if it's a transplant thing. The whole team held hands, you know, with your sterile gloves, whether it was 5 people, 4 people who were scrubbed in before the case during the timeout. Is that something that is transplant specific or UC specific?
That is UC transplant specific. So I'm not sure where it got started. Mo is one of the scrub techs that now is at Christ. She used to work at UC. She said she was one who started it because, you know, it brings everybody to a standstill, yeah. You know, so you're like, oh, you know, now you're not going to be able to move. Where I had come, we did have a timeout where everybody had to just put their hands down and stop. But I really appreciated the hand-holding because it really kind of brings together the sacredness of the moment, you know, and I call it the circle of trust. We're going to start our circle of trust and really breaks the barriers down because we're already going to be in each other's space anyway. So we do it intentionally, mindfully, and we bring all the facts that we need and ask every single person, do you agree? Is there anything else that you need? So from a patient standpoint, it's great. And it fit well with, you know, how I like to do timeouts and time ins and times out. So, but it's definitely a UC thing. And, fortunately Shimmel Shah, our fearless leader, was a big proponent of this. And, you know, he also may be involved in making this happen, but he's definitely one of those people who wants it happen every time. So it's great. Cause you know, some people want to roll their eyes at this, like, what are we getting married? Yes. Married in a common purpose that we are going to be working together to get this patient safely through the surgery and safely to their next destination.
Yeah. If I may, from my standpoint as a trainee, it just felt a really healthy moment of reverence where everyone was unified. And to bring it back to the patient, I'm in the ICU right now, and it feels like we talk about the physiology far more than the patient, which is the patient. The balance for me is maybe a little off, but it felt in that moment a really healthy way to just step back to be on the same page. You know, it is kind of funny. Here I am, you know, whether it was you or Dr. Quill, and just kind of like holding their hand. Like I didn't know we were at that part of our relationship.
What is happening here? We're a Americans, we don't like touch. Okay.
Yeah, no, but I loved it. And basically, I'm just trying to sell those interested in surgery to transplant on there for a 4-week rotation because the team is great. You aren't going to be doing these 48-hour shifts. And you get to hold everyone's hand. So it's pretty awesome.
It is.
To recap, one of the things you've continually said is multidisciplinary. We have this transplant surgeons, folks who are working behind the scenes. The list would be extensive. Like we couldn't even go. We have a whole episode to all of the people that make it happen, which is outstanding. We obviously have different types of transplant. We can go above, below the diaphragm. Maybe would like to hear you talk a little bit about if there was like a moment as a trainee that really drew you to transplant. Obviously, you've talked a lot about the gestalt and the cool continuum of being a provider. But was there a moment when plowing through all of those challenges as a, you know, PGY, whatever, when you knew transplant was for you?
It was earlier for me. As I alluded to the fact that I was an older medical student, I had a circuitous route. I also went to community college, Tri-C, before I went to Case Western. So I'm one of those people who got their start at Tri-C and transferred to Case. So I was a slightly different medical student, but fortunately at Michigan, there was like a huge variety of kinds of people. So that was very useful. But as a first-year medical student, they had an opportunity to be a anesthesia tech. And I could then go to all the surgeries wherever I wanted to do, and I could work. So I was still, you know, because I used to having a job. So I worked that as a job, and I was able to go to, and I thought I was going to do ortho, because before medical school, I was a orthopedic research person, stem cells. So I really thought I wanted to do ortho. And the surgeries did not speak to me. It was not magical. But it was magical when I saw Chris Sonaday, who for the techs, they come and go, and you may not even notice them. You think medical students are invisible. Techs feel very invisible, at least when I wore the tech hat. And for a liver transplant, they have to do a lot of work. It's very stressful. You're kind of prepping. You have to do all this extra stuff. And anytime there was a liver transplant, the junior people were kind of kept away, so we weren't going to get yelled at and get, you know. But I had to go in the room. I had to do something because everybody else was busy. And this guy walks in, and I'm like, oh, he must be a tech. I don't know him. He's very nonchalant. He like made eye contact with me. It was amazing. But he sits down, and he starts his backbench of this liver. And that was Dr. Chris Sonaday. And, you know, I just sat with him, and I watched him do this. And then they did the transplant. It was a 4-hour liver transplant no blood products had to be given. And now I know those happen. They do happen. They happen here too, but it was not necessarily all the time. But they were talking continuously, like, how are you doing? What else do we need to do? Okay, I'm going to take the... I mean, half of the stuff I didn't understand what they were talking about or how he was making adjustments with the anesthesiology person when I was a MS1. I think that was like towards the MS1 to 2 or time. So anyway, so I was just like, this is amazing. I loved the surgery, having that liver kind of change color, and I, you know, having the privilege of being there, especially when it was your preclinical years, was a great gift.
Yeah.
And that's what made me do an extra my sub-I and transplant. And then when the entire residency, you know, my mentors were trying to talk me out of it because they're like, oh, but don't you want a family? I mean, don't you want to have a life? I mean, jokingly, like transplant people are people who have a little bit of self-hatred or something. I'm like, you know, that was one of my good mentors. He's like, yeah, I love him to death. But I was like, but one of my people was Rajab, and he was actually a transplant person, and I could not shake it. I could not shake the amazing parts of what transplant can do and transplant can offer. But my magic moment happened when I was a medical student, watching a surgery that just made me feel like, wow. And nothing else dissuaded me when I was as a sub-I with Kristen Gooding. And that's when I really recognized that, wow, this is true multidisciplinary care, because we're rounding with this massive team. There's pharmacy talking. There's social. The dietitian's like, oh, well, I think we should do this for the two-fees. And I was like, this is a place. This is a place for me. And that's where I continue to go, apparently. And there's multiple ways. And I tell this to students, there's multiple ways to be happy. So you don't have to have a magic moment. There are a lot of places that we can fit in. But, you know, for me, I just happened to have a magic moment. And that magic moment was enough to propel me through this. And no, it has not gotten old. I still love when the liver kind of makes that new bile. You're like, oh, there's bile. any other surgery, if you said that, you're like, oh no, there's bile.
That's a good point.
But you know, that's what makes our day. And I think, you know, even if you talk to people who are way out, Rajab has been out for a long time. He was my mentor through medical school, through residency and fellowship. He still has that feeling like, you know, you can change people's lives. And you're one of many people in that group, but you get the ability to kind of really be having a front row seat, which is magic.
Yeah, that's awesome. To be the kind of counter to that, I don't feel like I had maybe had that magical moment, but that's okay as well. I honestly thought I did. There were multiple days. Pull back the curtain of Robbie's life. I like to journal, and there's multiple moments where I left med school and I was like, man, abdominal anatomy is cool. I'm going to be a pediatric surgeon. And, you know, got everything in line, got the scores, and just felt like pediatrics was the better fit. And there wasn't that aha moment that pulled me to pediatrics per se. But if you are one of those people who does have a moment and you want to be a mom and you want to have, you know, a life outside medicine, what I'm hearing you say is, you have those things. It comes in waves. Maybe it's a less of a maintenance IV rate. It's a bolus kind of life, a lifestyle. But some of those things that scared you away, I'm hearing you say, are valid, but didn't scare you away entirely. And you feel good about your decision.
I do. And I think one of the things that is lost, because we live very privileged lives and we get to see a lot of very privileged people, that when you're like, oh, your schedule is not great. Well, there are more people who have my kind of schedule in the world and don't get to do these kinds of things, who don't get people to like say, oh, you are awesome. People who spend entire lifetimes making it work with two jobs, three jobs, and see their kids just as much as I do without society saying, oh, you're good. You do a good job.
Yeah.
And we don't take that into account. We forget those people. And when we're like, oh, how are you going to work that much? There's a lot of people, that's how they work day and night. I mean, I'm not sure how many, but a lot of people, you know, may have that kind of work life balance where you don't have that option and you don't necessarily get that amazing rush other than, you know, the fact that you're providing for your children. So the life is not great, but in my life, yes, you know, kids are very resilient. My daughter is amazing. One of the times when she was about to throw a fit, she was like, are you going to work? Are you just leaving me in my room because I'm not going to sleep? I'm like, because if you're going to work, I'm not going to cry. If you're just trying to make me go to sleep, then I'm going to start crying. And then I'm like, oh, today mommy's not going. So she's like, I'm going to cry now. So then she's like sitting there crying because she's adjusted. And, you know, she has a life that I'm glad that she has, but it's a tricky subject. But obviously, it's a matter of a perspective of what you're able to do with the time that you have. And my daughter is awesome. You see kids out of a lot of different environments, and they'll still love their parents because it's how you interact with them in the time that you have. She pats my head. I hope you have a good liver, mommy. I'm like, oh, I've been talking too much all night with you next to me, so you know that I have a liver to worry about. But I really thought she was going to say, I hope you have a good day. She's like, I hope you have a good liver. Oh. Thank you, honey. I love you too.
That's amazing. I love the refocus, the perspective. It's so true. Whether or not our listeners have seen folks who maybe work those hours but don't have the same paycheck at home, if you listen to our patients, you will definitely meet them in the hospital. And that's one of my favorite things. I've said it more than once on the podcast. One of the biggest privileges and favorite things of mine and being in Cincinnati is the patients we work with. You learn so much about the world, and it puts into perspective, like a transplant surgeon can recognize that it's worth it because of the impact they make. And the hours, as you mentioned, it's not too dissimilar from what many in the world go through to provide for their families. So I am really grateful for your redirection there. I want to give you the mic for one last question for our medical student listeners. Would you have any advice for those looking to go into transplant, whether it's practical or philosophical, for those who are trying to make that decision?
I think I alluded to it. Really knowing yourself and what degree of uncertainty you're okay with. Knowing yourself is the most important part of trying to figure out what you are going to be happy doing. because you can fall in love with something temporarily, but you really need to know, is this something that you can do? Is it high is going to be good enough for all of the life? What part of your life are you not? I mean, there are people who are like, oh, I could not bear the uncertainty. If that's the case, and no, transplant's not necessarily for you. However, there's a fit for everybody, and there's more than one fit. I think that's basically what it comes down to. There's more than one fit. You have to be interested in the patient population. I have my face-to-face conversations about really about the patients. Like, if you care too deeply about a patient group, then you should not be doing that, because you yourself are going to be at some time responsible for hurting them, either by doing something or not doing something on time. Can you get up again and do that same thing again? Can you walk to the next room? Can you survive? And you cannot do it if you don't like that patient population. If you cannot empathize and be in their space and try to figure out why they're there and how you can see some part of them that you can try to help from their perspective, then you can't be their doctor. So for peds, you know, I couldn't do it. I could not bear the idea. Because I love ped surgery. I loved ped surgery as well.
It's awesome.
It is magical, you know, and the kids are great. You get to play. You're like, oh, that's an excuse. I can, you know, do all these things. But can you survive if they don't make it? Can you go and provide excellent care the very next moment? That's the question. Similarly for, you know, somebody who, smoking cessation, amputations, you're like, oh, you're going to lose your finger. Well, I'm going to keep smoking. Well, we're not going to give you any resources to try to help you quit smoking or try to help you, get Chantix or this or that, or kind of counseling, anything. We're not going to do any of those things, but since you're not quitting smoking, we're just going to have to do more than one surgery. Are you okay with that? Are you okay with putting 14 hours into a situation where you're not going to, like, the system is going to be okay with paying for a 14-hour surgery, three-month hospital stay, but not okay with paying for their smoking cessation? Is that going to drive you insane? If so, then that's not the field to go to. So it's basically, it's process of knowing yourself, knowing what degree of uncertainty you're okay with, knowing what things you cannot stand whatsoever, but knowing that if you care too much, you won't be able to survive either. It's a balance between self-care and patient care.
That's excellent. I feel like we could probably continue this conversation for a really long time. I wanted to make one last plug to our listeners, because I was really impacted by getting to meet one of the living kidney donors and kind of develop a relationship with him throughout my time following his story. I am looking forward to being a living, hopefully, kidney donor someday. And to our listeners, that's a thing. Like, you can aspire to be that. You know, some of my friends are now foster parents or adopting. I'm like, oh, that's so cool. Kidney donor list. Put that on your list, UCOM students. Dr. Silski can help really impact someone's life with that. So totally my plan, and it would encourage you all to consider it too.
That is pretty amazing. I do feel like that is the one part of our humanity that nobody can debate. That's a true hero, because you're electing to go through a procedure for somebody else, to change somebody's life. I mean, it is the most amazing part of my job, especially meeting living donors. You sit there fascinated, like, how did you come to the decision? And it's amazing, especially when they call you after, like, oh, I did my bike ride. I feel great. I'm like, oh, look at you being fabulous. Like, it is the most inspiring part of my job, living donor. Like, donor, I say, call them donor Monday, donor Tuesdays are the best days. Like, those are the days when I'm going in chipper as all I can think about. That's next Monday. I'm like, I cannot wait to be part of that amazing, beautiful gift. So good luck.
Yeah, it's clearly not I'm not on anyone's Monday or Tuesday schedule yet, but I hope to in the future, whether it's answering the call of someone, a loved one, or, you know, hitting that 40-year-old, you know, Monday morning and I feel like, oh, it's time.
Even if it is just to talk about it too, just knowing, yeah, what the process is and how people go through that evaluation, what their risks are compared to the general population. And just so everybody knows, God forbid you are a living donor and you donated one kidney and you get into a car accident 20 years later that happens to destroy your other kidney. That puts that person at the top of the list. So they are contingency plans in the unlikely event that that's the that you become or need a kidney yourself. But the risk for a donor to need a kidney transplant themselves is the same as the general population, mostly probably because we're selecting out the healthiest of the healthiest people. If you really like trying to look through the data, but it is the most amazing thing that I get to participate in, to see that amazing gift. But
yeah, when I heard that statistic, the chance of needing a transplant is the same as the general population, I was sold. So all about it. Well, Dr. Silski, thank you so much for your time, for coming on, for being an advocate for patients in Cincinnati and also all across the Midwest. For those who are looking to get honors on transplant surgery, what song should they cue up for day one with you in the OR?
Oh, I'm not particular. You can rock it from country to emo to hip hop. I'm all for anybody singing, regardless of the genre.
Awesome. You heard it here first. Well, thanks again. And listeners, we hope you enjoy. Feel free to connect with Dr. Silski on Twitter or try to request your transplant surgery rotation in your M3 year. Thanks again, Dr. Silski.
Thank you. Pleasure being here.